This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. This morning, we're exploring a couple of contentious topics, like the impact of Confederate monuments standing in our region.
We have this very strong assumption that memorials promote healing and reconciliation. But from a social science standpoint, we actually have little to no evidence of this.
That, and we'll also explore the concept of universal basic income in Appalachia. It's coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. West Virginia Governor Jim Justice has extended an order that closed all bars in Monongalia County for an additional 10 days because of the coronavirus pandemic. The latest order is effective until August 13th. The county includes West Virginia University's Morgantown campus. Students start moving back into campus residence halls starting August 15th for the fall semester. Mon County has reported at least 900 confirmed virus cases, by far the most in the state, according to state health officials. More than half of the county's active cases are in the 20 to 29 age group. Justice initially closed the county's bars on July 13th. He extended the 10-day order on July 23rd and again on Saturday. The order does allow customers to purchase takeout food and drinks from Mon County bars. It also allows dining in bar areas or restaurants, hotels, and other similar facilities. Statewide, there have been at least 6,850 confirmed cases and 117 deaths, according to officials. Statues set in stone signify a sense of eternity. But that view is changing rapidly, as recent events demonstrate. A Virginia Tech sociologist has been exploring how people in communities with Confederate statues relate to them today. Robbie Harris spoke to her.
So in the United States specifically, we have this very strong assumption that memorials promote healing and reconciliation. But from a social science standpoint, we actually have little to no evidence of this.
Ashley Reichelman is with the Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention at Virginia Tech.
The interesting component that I have found in my research is the idea that the wide majority of people almost have no interaction with the statue throughout their lifetime. It's not as if it's something that they drive by and revere.
She talked with people in three different Virginia towns about the Confederate soldier statue, found at government offices and public property in cities and towns all over the South.
And it was only ever tourists that even acknowledged, went up and read them, right, to try to take some value from them or to understand their meaning.
For the study, Reichelman spent many hours observing people and the statues in the different towns.
There is very little interaction with them at the local level.
She says to most people, the statues in their towns were part of the landscape, ingrained, unchanging, and so barely seen. But Reichelman points out that by definition, all statues are political.
No matter where you stand in this debate, you must acknowledge that statue is a symbol. So the reality is then when something is a symbol, we have to understand that that means it can be interpreted in multiple ways. In the context of where we are existing now, there are social ways, there are political ways, there are human rights ways to interpret it. And these often overlap.
To conduct her research project, she placed ads in local newspapers and in libraries, inviting people to talk about these issues. At first, there was some concern that Reichelman, a white woman from the North, was asking these questions about the monuments. Was she coming from a particular point of view?
My role as a researcher is not to teach someone, but it was to be taught by them. So in context, what I wanted to know is I wanted them to teach me what they knew and how they came to know it.
One of her respondents said he sees Confederate soldier statues as a memorial to principle. Another sees it as an effort to make a hero out of someone, a statement of division, boldly built in physical form. But the wide majority of respondents were most concerned that without the statues, young generations would not be fully educated about the Civil War.
And this becomes important because a lot of respondents and a lot of the discussion about the idea that taking down the statues is erasing history, it seems like a lot of people are believing that individuals are actually learning from these statues.
The very opposite of what Reichelman found in her research. Reichelman completed her study before the full force of the Black Lives Matter movement dominated the news, but she says the antecedents began showing up in the literature in the past several years.
If we don't follow the mechanisms and keep track of the processes, then similar to just putting up memorials and taking them down, we don't fundamentally know what caused the change. So some of the goals are trying to understand and more deeply be able to contribute to the precise causes and effects about how our society is changing.
Reichelman's study on Confederate monuments in communities will be published in the near future. It's titled Chiseled in Stone: Local Meanings of Confederate Statues in Virginia. In Blacksburg, I'm Robbie Harris.
Universal Basic Income, or UBI, unconditional, government-subsidized, regular cash payments for adults, is back in vogue. A basic income has been discussed as part of a strategy to reduce poverty in the U.S. since the 1970s. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic continues to push millions of Americans out of work. In much of Appalachia, including West Virginia, unemployment rates have reached nearly 20% in some areas. And folks still working feel the pinch of the pandemic, too. Laura Harbert Allen has more.
It's a hot, bright day in mid-July at the Laidley Transit Mall in downtown Charleston, West Virginia. People talk and listen to music as buses pull in and out of the station. I'm on a bus with Matt Murphy today to talk with him about Universal Basic Income, or UBI.
My name is Matt Murphy, and I work as a commercial traffic manager for a commercial radio company here in West Virginia. We're a statewide radio company.
With basic income, U.S. adults would receive a monthly payment with no strings attached. Recipients decide how to spend the cash.
It's basically the money that you can count on to do the basic things that we need to do day in and day out in life. You can buy groceries. You can pay your electric bill. You can pay your water bill. It can help you to pay your rent.
In West Virginia, UBI hasn't gained any real political traction, but it's been covered in news reports as a way to help workers who have lost jobs due to the decline of the coal industry. Matt's story, though, shows that coal miners are not the only folks who need help. He just started his first full-time salaried job last year in his mid-30s, and he still struggles.
There's absolutely no way that I could afford to have an apartment with the bills associated with that, also to have a car, and to be able to eat and have any kind of extra enjoyment in life. I mean, there would just be no room in my budget to do anything.
And that was Matt's situation before the pandemic. He's still getting by, living with his grandmother, riding the bus. But his budget is tighter now after taking a 10% pay cut due to a furlough at work. Has a pandemic created space to take a basic income from idea to political reality?
It's an interesting moment for sure.
Carolyn West is an assistant professor of cultural studies at George Mason University in Virginia.
With the legislation that provided, even that's temporary, this additional $600 per week on top of the state standard unemployment weekly maximum, I think we're seeing some kind of idea of what possibly a UBI could do. Of course, you're also seeing the political front saying, well, people are disincentivized to work. You know, it's always been asked to work.
For West, UBI is about putting choices into people's hands. That matters, she says, especially in places like the Appalachian coalfields.
What our system, you know, relies on are these big companies to kind of bring in their big dollars. I am much more interested in how people, you know, can create their own kind of initiative.
But not everybody thinks UBI should come with no conditions.
You know, you are going somewhere to learn a trade. You know, that will give you that step up where you can be in a position to take care of yourself.
Reverend Roberta Smith is president of Charleston's Black Ministerial Alliance. She's worked with congregations throughout the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia since the early 90s. She thinks subsidies for training programs like college, trade school, and certifications should be part of the social safety net. But she also notes that a basic income would keep people from spending time going from place to place to get help with things like paying for utilities and food assistance, time they could spend doing other things, like looking for work.
We have a lot of governmental things that going on and a lot of nonprofits that supply a lot of like food and utility assistance, but we could have that money, you know, like consistent, even if you could have it, you know, for a period.
For Reverend Smith, a basic income could be part of a broader social safety net in Appalachia to help people get out of poverty, but it's not a magic bullet. Todd Stafford, a PhD candidate in cultural studies at George Mason University, agrees.
How might we develop a social right to housing, a social right to health care, a social right to education, a social right to child care that isn't predicated on just giving money to people and letting them spend it in the market?
Stafford also thinks Appalachia has lessons that should inform policymakers in the nation about that net.
Automation came to Appalachia real early. One possible way for us to look at that and take a lesson from it for the rest of the nation, we could be capturing some of that revenue and feeding it into something like a social wealth fund that would then fund social programs, whether that be a UBI or Medicare for All or housing or food or child care.
Back on the bus, Matt Murphy reflects on what a basic income could mean for the region and the nation.
Maybe it's just kind of growing up, we have that idea of the American dream, but to me, it seems like we should be able to not just work to live, but to actually be able to enjoy life a little bit. And unfortunately, there's just not enough income for a lot of us right now to be able to do that. It's just getting by money.
For folks like Matt in Appalachia and the nation, a basic income could be a tool that helps them do more than just get by. As a global pandemic pushes political leaders to issue stimulus payments and extend unemployment benefits, some say a basic income could be part of a logical next step. For 100 Days in Appalachia, I'm Laura Harbert Allen in Charleston, West Virginia.
Laura's reporting comes to us from a partnership between 100 Days in Appalachia, Scalawag Magazine, and Spotlight on Poverty and Opportunity. You can read more at 100daysinappalachia.com. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Andrea Billups is our news director. I'm your host and producer this morning, Glynis Board. This is West Virginia Morning.